he conducted the importation of tin from Britain. It is of record that he was a Roman official, a decurio. In fact, some of the early writings speak of him as nobilis decurio. Now, a decurio was a Roman official in charge of mines. And Joseph of Arimathea was one of high standing. He was a member of the Roman Provincial Senate, as well as a member of the Jewish Sanhedrin. That accounts for the fact that he was able to give some protection against the hatred of the Jews. Now, he alone dared go to Pontius Pilate to claim the body of Jesus Christ for burial after the crucifixion. Theoretically, any near relative of one officially executed could come immediately after his death and claim the body for burial, that under both Jewish and Roman law. But anyone who had dared to do so, to claim that from the Jewish Sanhedrin, would undoubtedly have been murdered. Joseph of Arimathea had the standing to go direct to Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, ignoring the Sanhedrin, and claim the body. And it was in his tomb that the body of Christ was laid and from which he was resurrected. After the death of Christ, Jewish hatred was, of course, as strong as before. And the persecution of anyone who admitted he was a Christian was, of course, very intense. You read in your Bible of how Saul of Tarsus, who became the Apostle Paul, was among those who hunted down the Christians and had them imprisoned or murdered. And after they'd been hunted down or driven into exile in Palestine, Saul was on his way as far as Damascus in Syria to try to have them arrested and brought to Jerusalem for imprisonment or execution. At the time when he was converted, and God had to knock him down to get him to pay attention then, remember. It wasn't long after the crucifixion that the Apostle Stephen was murdered, the first of the Christian martyrs. And it continued just getting constantly worse. Now, the early Christian writers, many of them, agree that by the year 36 AD, practically all Christians were scattered out of Judea by the persecution. In fact, it was in the year 35 that Saul was on his way to Damascus when God brought him to his senses. Now, the emperor Tiberius, who reigned as emperor from the years 14 to 37 AD, Tiberius, of course, wanted no disturbances at all in his empire. And he was having trouble enough with the Jews as it was, and the furor arising between the Jews and the Christians, he decided should be stamped out. Also, the Gauls were not limited to France. Some of them had spilled over the Alps down into northern Italy, and they were troublesome there too. So by edict, Emperor Tiberius established the death penalty for believing either Christianity or Druidism. Now, up to the time of crucifixion, the followers of Christ had had a little protection against the Jews. Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, knew and despised utterly the Jews. And you notice that when the Jews came to him with their lies against Christ, he was not deceived. However, Pontius Pilate was a pretty slippery character himself. He had been one of the parties to a conspiracy to assassinate Tiberius. It fell through, and Tiberius never discovered, Tiberius the emperor never discovered that Pontius Pilate was one of the members of the plot. But the Jewish high priest, Caiaphas, knew of this. And with this, he blackmailed Pontius Pilate. Now, the Bible records the trial of Jesus Christ before Pilate, and four separate times Pilate found him not guilty. He said, "I find in him no fault at all." And yet, under pressure from Caiaphas, he gave in and said, "All right, I know he's innocent, but let's have him killed." But now, when Tiberius issued this edict, making a death penalty for believing in Christianity, there was no protection at all within the Roman Empire for Christians. Many reliable authorities among the early Christian writers say that in 36 A.D., Joseph of Arimathea, with a party of 12 other Christians, were set adrift in a boat in the Mediterranean, towed out to sea and set adrift, no oars, no sails. And that eventually the party reached Marseille on the French Mediterranean coast. Now, whether a ship came along and picked them up, or whether it was a miraculous wind and tide that sent them there, you can take your own choice. There's no record of how it was done. But the fact that they got there is quite definite because of historical records. The party included Mary Magdalene, Martha, her maid Marcella, Lazarus, Maximin, a man who had been blind and Jesus Christ restored his sight, the apostles Philip and James, Mary, the wife of Cleopas, and Mary, the mother of Jesus. Cardinal Baronius, who was the greatest church historian of the Catholic Church, lived in the 16th century. He quotes from various authentic sources on this, among the recognized historians of the early Christian period. Isidore, Archbishop of Seville, from 600 to 636 A.D., Julian, Archbishop of Toledo, 680 to 690 A.D., Fricolpus, Bishop of Lisieux in France, A.D. 825 to 851, are among those who have recorded these facts in their church history. Well, these early church historians record that soon after the arrival of Joseph of Arimathea and St. Philip and the rest of the party at Marseille, a delegation of Druids from Britain came over and asked them to come to Britain and teach Christianity there. Remember now that basically Druidism had Christianity. Like the Old Testament, and I've talked to you before about this, all the Old Testament is simply symbolic of the coming of Christ, his sacrifice on the cross, his resurrection, and so on. But of course, since at that time he had not yet come, it looked to the future. Druidism, in other words, was the Old Testament. Now, they were expecting a Redeemer named Yesu, who would come and give his life to save them. He would be killed for no fault of his own to pay the penalty of their sins. Now, they'd already heard, remember, from the time of the crucifixion, variously dated from 30 to 33 A.D., from that time on, you had had uninterrupted voyages by the traders carrying this news. All this disturbance in Palestine, you can bet, was learned there. So, they had heard Yesu had come and had been murdered And they said, well, this is what we've been waiting for all this time. Now come and tell us about it. And it is of record that the Celtic peoples, who could not be induced to abandon their Druidic religion and accept Roman paganism, they were murdered literally by the millions by the Romans trying to stamp out Druidism. And they got nowhere. These people would not give up their religion. But they accepted Christianity with no argument, no trouble. Now, there were a great number of Christian martyrs in England through the centuries. Martyred first by the Roman military might, and later by Roman Catholicism. But only one Christian martyr in Britain who was put to death by these Celtic people. And that was only because they bitterly hated, of course, the Romans. And this man, having come out of the Roman Empire, they thought, well, here's another Roman trying to put something over on us, and they killed him before they found out who he was. Now, Roman attacks on Britain were no mere accident. Julius Caesar had gone into Gaul to conquer Gaul, and the Celtic people of Britain were sending troops to aid their fellow Celts in Gaul against the Roman armies. And so, the Romans sent a punitive expedition into Britain under Julius Caesar, starting in 55 BC and again in 54 BC. And Roman attacks continued sporadically until the middle 300s AD. And they never, contrary to what your school histories have told you, they never did actually conquer Britain. Well, Philip, the Apostle Philip, remained principally in Gaul, though he went to Britain on at least two occasions for a short time to see how things were getting along there. Philip was the apostle to Gaul, but he ordained Joseph of Arimathea as the apostle to Britain and sent him with his companions to start the church in Britain. Prince Arviragus, head of one of these Celtic Britain kingdoms, offered to give them land and protection against Roman persecution. Now, this Arviragus was the Prince of Cornwall. He was a cousin of Caradoc, the King of Wales. And it's interesting to note that the great King Arthur and the later Tudor kings of Egypt are descendants of Caradoc. The Romans corrupted the name to Caractacus, and you may have heard of him in your histories under that name.
The king of what?
The Tudor kings of England.
Oh,
did I? Yeah, the Tudor kings of England were descended from Caradoc. Well, the attacks continued by the Romans, and the first defense against these continuing Roman attacks were led by Arviragus, King of Cornwall. The Emperor Claudius, in AD 42, again made an edict that the penalty for belief in either Druidism or Christianity would be death. And he sent the largest and best-equipped Roman army that had been raised to that date to conquer Britain. Now remember how wide the Roman Empire was. Rome had taken Greece, had taken Egypt, had taken Carthage and all the North African shore. They had taken Asia Minor. They had conquered far into Babylonia, and they didn't have much trouble. And here was this one little island out there, and they sent their biggest, best-equipped armies, led by their best generals, and for three centuries, They couldn't really conquer it. Well, after the first couple of battles, Caradoc, the king of Wales, joined Arviragus. Now, you had not one nation of Britain. You had a number of small kingdoms. In other words, separate tribes, you might say, among them. Caradoc had been educated both in the Druid universities and to some extent at Rome. He was elected Pendragon, commander-in-chief. Now, he led them in 9 years of ceaseless warfare against the best Roman generals, and the Romans had little more than a toehold in Britain in all that time. Many of the Roman writers, Tacitus, Martial, Juvenal, and so on, record the reckless courage of these British warriors. They weren't afraid of these excellently trained, excellently equipped Roman legions. They simply swarmed over them and cut them to pieces. And their battle cry was the Druid motto, the truth against the world. Like Julius Caesar, these other Roman writers said that when the Romans occasionally did defeat the British, instead of it dampening their spirits, it only increased the ardor with which they fought. Well, during this period, after the first 2 years of continued failure, the Emperor Claudius asked for a 6-month armistice to discuss peace terms and invited Caradoc and Arviragus to Rome to try to negotiate a peace. Well, the Romans wanted to dictate terms of peace and the British weren't having any. The Romans were going to stamp out Christianity, so they were not acceptable. But to show you what the Romans, in spite of the things they wrote about the British as savages and so on, what the Romans thought of them, and this is recorded Roman history now we're talking about. The Emperor Claudius offered his daughter, Venus Julia, in marriage to Arviragus, king of Cornwall. And they were married in Rome in the year 45 A.D. Meantime, the chief Roman commander in Britain during this armistice was married to Gladys, the sister of Caradoc. Well, when the British refused to compromise on the religious issue, the war was resumed. So the Roman army then was led by the four ablest generals that Rome had: Aulus Plautius, Vespasian, who was later to become emperor, his son Titus, the man who destroyed Jerusalem in AD 70, and Geta. And they found themselves so swamped by the British resistance, they pleaded with Claudius for help, so that he came over with two more Roman legions, a squadron of elephants, and a large number of other auxiliary troops. Now, they did not defeat the British armies. By treachery, treason, Caradoc was betrayed to the Romans, and he and his immediate family were taken to Rome as prisoners. Now, usually, because no more bestial people have ever been known in human history than the Romans, usually, prisoners were tortured to death under circumstances of extreme cruelty. Instead of this, Caradoc, who appeared before the Roman Senate, addressed them, by the way, in Latin, and gave a very beautiful speech. I don't have it copied here, but he aroused their admiration so that they required him to remain 7 years as a hostage in Rome and to swear that he would never, in the rest of his life, take up arms against Rome again. The other members of his family could remain with him there, but while Caradoc was not free to leave Rome during the 7 years, the other members could. And a couple of his sons went back to Britain, one of them becoming king in his place. They allowed Caradoc the income from his estates in Britain so he could live as befitted a nobleman. and they assigned him a large, well, a palace. It was known as the Palatium Britannicum, the British Palace. While he was there, by the way, the daughter of Caradoc, Gladys, was adopted by the Emperor Claudius as his daughter. And she was married to Rufus Pudens Pudentius, a Roman senator in the year 53. Now, Pudens was already a Christian convert. In the Epistles to the Romans, chapter 16, verse 13, Paul sends greetings to Rufus and to his mother and mine. Now, you remember, Paul was a Roman citizen. He was born of Benjamite parents and born in a Roman city and a Roman citizen by birth. His father died no great length of time after his birth, and his mother was married thereafter to a Roman senator. So Rufus Pudens was a half-brother of Paul. They had the same mother, not the same father. Now, the various Britons, Caradoc and his relatives, living at this British palace in Rome, were all that made possible the first Roman church. Because remember, all this time, Christianity was condemned by law. And only the fact that these were people of that importance and that influence enabled the meetings of the early Christians in Rome to take place at the British palace. The Romans still kept trying to conquer Britain. As I say, it went on until the middle 300s. It was broken by periodic armistices, and these invariably were under treaties which recognized the British as allies, not conquered subjects of the Romans. The British kings kept their authority and their privileges and liberties, which is something the Romans did not do to conquered lands. Another one of these Britons, in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 21, Paul speaks of Pudens, the same Rufus Pudens, and Linus. Now, Linus was another British prince who by this time was a Christian priest in Rome. Well, all this was in the 50s and 60s A.D. So even the existence of just a small church in Rome did not come as early as the existence of a Christian church in Britain, which began in the year 37 A.D. All church records, including the records of the Vatican itself, agree that the British church was established in the last year of the reign of the Emperor Tiberius, which was 37 A.D. Another indication of the degree of civilization of the British is this. Seneca, who had some reputation as a philosopher, an even greater reputation as a crook who made money any way he could, and as the richest man in Rome, Seneca loaned the equivalent of $10 million in our modern money to Prasutagus, the king of the British tribe of the Iceni. He loaned it to him on the security of the public buildings of the Iceni. Now, you try to get a loan of $10 million today on buildings, and you've got to have some pretty good buildings to get it on, don't you? And remember, $10 million then was equal to more than $100 million today in relative value. Now, by one of these periodic armistice treaties, the Romans had freedom of residence and travel within the domain of the Iceni and the Coronian tribes in Britain. Well, when Prasutagus, this king who borrowed the money, died, the Romans, they were predatory scoundrels, but then so were most other nations in that day, The Roman seized the opportunity now to treacherously attack the Iceni. They massacred many of them. There were horrible massacres, rapes, robberies. The Romans stole everything they could, occupied the lands and houses of the wealthy people and so on. And Queen Boadicea, the widow of Prasutagus, there was one of the great figures of history. She roused the British and led the combined armies of at least four of these British kingdoms against the Romans in the year 60 A.D. And she did a remarkable job. Roman armies were defeated and destroyed just wholesale, to the point where some of the high Roman generals abandoned their armies and fled to Gaul for their lives. The Roman writer Tacitus reports that over 80,000 Roman soldiers were killed in this one war. London had been taken over by the Romans. It was a great commercial city under the Romans. And Boadicea with her armies attacked it, and the Roman records show that of the defenders, Roman soldiers and all, 40,000 were slaughtered there. Finally, in one battle, Boadicea and a few troops around her were cut off from the rest of the army. And thinking she was in danger of immediate capture by the Romans and knowing how she'd be treated by them, she committed suicide. Well, upon the death of her husband, Boadicea had been publicly flogged by the Romans and her two daughters raped in public before her. So the Romans knew that during her lifetime there was no point in talking peace terms to her. But on her death, they sought peace terms. And it's interesting to note, the Roman historians themselves show that they restored all the confiscated properties to the Iceni. The debt to Seneca for this borrowed $10 million was canceled, and Rome paid a heavy indemnity. Does that sound like Romans dealing with a conquered people? Well, now let's sum this up. The first church in Britain started in 37 A.D. The first church in Rome during the 50s A.D. But the church in Rome got nowhere. Far from Rome being the helper of Christianity, until the Emperor Constantine, Rome was the greatest enemy of Christianity. Rome didn't even tolerate Christianity until 313 A.D., when Constantine had secured power as emperor by the sword and issued his edict of toleration. So Rome was definitely not a Christian nation. The first faint beginnings of what ultimately became the Catholic Church didn't start until long after the death of Constantine. But from 37 on, you had had in Britain, without a break, a Christian church. In all their furious attacks on Britain trying to stamp out Christianity, the Romans never penetrated as far as Glastonbury, where Joseph of Arimathea had set up his headquarters. They lost scores of thousands of troops trying to get there, but the Britons always turned them back. The trouble with so many of these topics I take for discussion is that they always dovetail around the edges with other things, each one of which would take one or two evenings to discuss in itself. And the Christian church in Britain, headquarters at Glastonbury, and the many missionaries they sent out into Ireland, into Scotland, into Gaul, into various places throughout the Roman Empire. That'd be a whole evening's discussion in itself, so we won't go into that. But you had a thriving, uninterrupted Christian church in Britain from the year 37 A.D. on. Now, in the year 156 A.D., King Lucius, at a national council, officially proclaimed Britain to be a Christian nation. That is the first time in history that any nation ever adopted Christianity. Remember now, it was over 160 years after that before the Romans even tolerated it. And here Christianity was made the official religion of Britain in 156 A.D. Now, much as the Roman Catholic Church likes to claim to be first and most important in everything, the records of the Vatican show that all this is true. There have been a number of important church councils, and at these, as the delegates from the different nations came, there was, of course, a lot of jealousy over who would be recognized as more important than someone else. And it depended, of course, upon how early Christianity had been accepted in the nation from which these delegates came. And in every instance, the delegates from Britain were officially recognized as coming from the first Christian church. Among these, the great ecclesiastical council at the city of Pisa in A.D. 1417, at Constance in A.D. 1419, at Siena in A.D. 1423. And in each of these cases, it was officially determined, based upon Vatican records, that the Christian church in Britain, founded by Joseph of Arimathea, was the first Christian church. You'll remember that in the reign of Henry VIII, Britain broke away from Roman Catholicism, which had been the official religion, and you had the English Reformation. During the time that the quarrel between King Henry VIII and the Pope was going on, leading up to the official break, an eminent Catholic official, Polydore Vergil, wrote at that time that the British church was the first church to be, Christian church, to be established in any nation in the world. So, the first Christian nation, and the one which has been continuously Christian ever since, was Britain.